I'm ready.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming. It's great to have everyone here. And, of course, wouldn't be possible without the gracious support of our sponsor, Rolls-Royce. So thanks very much to Rolls-Royce. I'm very honored to introduce our keynote speaker for this afternoon, General George Casey, the 36th Chief of Staff of the Army. He has a long and distinguished almost 40 years of service. All things come full circle. He started his career here in Washington, D.C. as a ROTC student at Georgetown. And he's held numerous staff and command assignments throughout his career, including the Director of Strategic Plans and Policy in the J-5 and the Joint Staff, and as the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army. Prior to becoming the Chief of Staff of the Army, he served as the Multinational Forces Iraq Commander. And we're very pleased to have you here today.
You.
Thanks for coming.
Okay.
Take it away.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you. I guess I'm the last of the group here. I don't know if you've been following the whole QDR series, but I think I'm the last of the service chiefs to come in and talk about the QDR and the Army and the Army's part in it. So I'm happy to do that. And you can decide whether it's saving the best for last or the last for last. I don't know. We'll see. Secretary Gates has talked about a balanced strategy. And I'd like to talk about what a balanced Army looks like in a balanced strategy, because that's the direction that we're heading as an Army. I will tell you that we have been moving away from our Cold War roots since September 11th. Since before September 11th, actually, and it picked up speed after that. We began converting ourselves from Cold War organizations to modular organizations more relevant in the current environment in 2004. We're 85% done converting our brigades. That's about 300 brigades that we have converted, and we'll finish converting by 11. We are about two-thirds of the way through rebalancing the Army away from Cold War skills to skills more relevant in the 21st century. All told, about 150 soldiers will change jobs. To put that in perspective for you, we've taken down around 200 tank companies, artillery batteries, and air defense batteries, and we have stood up an equivalent number of military police, engineers, special forces, civil affairs, and psychological operations companies. And the whole purpose of this is to shift our weight into a force that is more versatile in moving across the spectrum of conflict. It's been an interesting transformation for us. When I was a division commander in Germany in 99 to 2001, and if you had asked me the question, General Casey, where on the spectrum of conflict should you optimize your unit's training so that you can be most versatile to move up and down the spectrum of conflict, I would have told you, if we can do conventional war, we can do anything. After 32 months in Iraq, I don't believe that. And I think there's an awful lot of folks in the Army that don't believe that. And so we are shifting not only our operational concept away from air-land battle to what we call full-spectrum operations. Army formations will simultaneously apply offense, defense, and stability operations to seize and retain the initiative and achieve decisive results. And we're shifting our focus away from major conventional operations to a focus that can deal with hybrid threats. And I define hybrid threats as diverse combinations of irregular conventional terrorist and criminal elements that are employed asymmetrically to go against our strengths and to allow the enemy to achieve their objectives. And so we are shaping ourselves to deal with those kinds of threats. All told, what we're trying to build is a versatile mix of tailorable organizations that is organized on a rotational cycle to generate a sustained flow of forces for full-spectrum operations and to hedge against uncertainties, and to do that at a ratio, a deployment ratio, that is sustainable for an all-volunteer force. Now, that's a mouthful. And let me talk you through how we get there. And for me, it all starts with the environment. And so as we look out at the environment, what do we see? I've been saying for the last really couple of years here that, one, we're at war. And we've been at war for 7+ years. I believe that this war that we're involved in is a long-term ideological struggle that we're going to be engaged in some form or another for an extended period of time. Against that background, I see the trends around the globe as making that period of that conflict, they're more likely to exacerbate that conflict than they are to ameliorate it. What am I talking about? Globalization. Up until recently, globalization was having a fairly positive effect in a lot of places around the world. It's interesting that we're so connected that the adverse implications of the economic drawdown or collapse here has been distributed around the world as well. But what that's also done is created a haves and have-nots, and the have-nots are easily more readily targetable by these extremist organizations. Technology is another double-edged sword. The same technology that is being used to bring knowledge to anyone with a computer and a hookup is being used by terrorists to export terror around the globe. Demographics, also going in the wrong direction. I've seen studies that say that the populations of some of these developed countries like Pakistan are expected to double in a decade. You imagine the implications of that for an already stretched government. Other studies say that by 2030, 60% of the population of the world is expected to live in cities. That says an awful lot for where we're going to have to operate. And the other interesting element of demographic leads toward competition for resources. The middle classes in India and China are already larger than the population of the United States. That's a lot of two-car families. And then the two trends that worry me most are weapons of mass destruction in the hands of terrorists and safe havens, places, countries, or parts of countries where the local government can't or won't deny their country as a safe haven for terrorists. So when you put all those together against the background that we are already involved in a long-term ideological struggle, what I see is a future of persistent conflict. And I define persistent conflict as a period of protracted confrontation among state, non-state, and individual actors who are increasingly willing to use violence to accomplish their political and ideological objectives. And that tells me, as the Chief of Staff of the Army, that I need a way of ensuring that I have a sustained flow of trained and ready forces at a level of deployment ratio that is sustainable for an all-volunteer force. One. The second element that I look at is what's the nature of war and what's the character of conflict in this era, and you can get all wrapped around the axle with the doctrine folks, and they've convinced me that the nature of war is immutable and it doesn't change, but the character of conflict does change, and so we've looked hard at what we think the character of conflict in the 21st century is going to be like. And frankly, we have come to the conclusion that it's going to be more like what's happening in Iraq, Afghanistan, and indeed southern Lebanon in 2006 than necessarily the large armored formation attacks across the plains of northern Europe or the deserts of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. And, you know, I spent some time in Iraq, and I've got a pretty good sense of what that environment's like, but I really looked hard at what happened in Lebanon in the summer of 2006. Because what you see is a non-state actor, Hezbollah, operating inside a state, Lebanon, supported by two other states, Syria and Iran, and operating against a fourth state, Israel. And they embedded themselves in the population centers north of the Israeli borders. They used improvised explosive devices to channelize the attacking Israeli armored formations into kill zones where they fired at them with state-of-the-art anti-tank guided missiles. 40% of the Israeli casualties came from those anti-tank guided missiles. They shot down an Israeli helicopter with a surface-to-air missile. They hit an Israeli corvette in the Mediterranean Sea with a cruise missile. They used unmanned aerial vehicles to target Israeli forces. They started the conflict with estimates of over 13,000 rockets. And not just the small rockets that they shoot at our base camps in Iraq and Afghanistan, but the 220-millimeter rockets. And they used secure cell phones and secure computers for command and control. And they got their message out on local television. That is a much more complex and difficult type of warfare. And I see more and more the character of conflict in the 21st century is being more like that than what we've been preparing to do all these years. And so we look at the environment of persistent conflict, we look at the character of conflict, and then ask ourselves, all right, what's the role of land forces then in this environment? And I define land forces as Army forces, Marine forces, Special Operating Forces, and the interagency forces, and the indigenous forces that we're operating with. And so what's the role, and what's the role particularly for the Army? First of all, we have to prevail in protracted counterinsurgency campaigns. We have to win the wars that we're in, as Secretary Gates puts it. Second, we have to be prepared to engage to help other countries build the capacity to deny their country to terrorists. And it's not just us training military forces. It may be us helping train police forces. It may be us helping build rule of law institutions and a range of other things. But again, a long-term ideological struggle, the countries have to be able to deny their countries as safe havens for terror. Third, I believe that we in the military will have to continue to provide support to civil authorities both at home and abroad. And we'll continue to do the work at home here largely through our National Guard, but we will augment them as required with active duty forces. I think the element of assisting other agencies of the government in a deployed environment is with us to stay. And you've all heard time and again, we won't win these conflicts by military means alone. All the elements of national power have to be brought to bear. We are very capable of planning, coordinating, and integrating. And we're doing that in Iraq and Afghanistan now, and I believe that's really a way of the future for us as we help bring in the other agencies of government to achieve our national objectives. And then lastly, we have to be able to deter and to defeat both hybrid threats and hostile state actors. And we have to be able to do that while shifting our focus away from organizations that are primarily designed to win conventional war. And because that's not what we're going to be doing for the rest of this century. Now, and this is a great subject for the QDR, because the organizing principle for the Department of Defense for 60 years has been major conventional war. Win one, hold the other enemies at bay long enough to defeat the first one and move on to the second one. But all the systems are designed to do that. You know, for example, we report our readiness of our forces based on their readiness to do their designed mission, which is major conventional war, even though we're sending them to Iraq and Afghanistan, organized, trained, and equipped at a very high level to succeed in combat. And I'm scratching my head and I'm saying, is that really what we need to be doing? There's lots of things like that all throughout the department that keep pulling you back toward major conventional war as the central organizing principle. We are making a conscious effort to try to move away from that direction. To do that, we adopted the doctrine of full spectrum operations. And you hear a lot of discussion about it's either irregular war or it's conventional war. And the more I listen to that, the more I'm convinced that that's not a helpful distinction. Because warfare, particularly warfare in the 21st century, is likely to be hybrid warfare. And war is war. And our forces have to be able to operate any place on the spectrum of conflict. And we are growing a generation of young leaders that are increasingly capable of doing that. Now, what does this army look like? And how would it be organized? If you think back to the elements, sustain commitment, hedge against contingencies, and sustain the all-volunteer force. We're looking at putting the entire army on a rotational cycle, much like the Navy and the Marine Corps have been on for years. This is a huge change for us. Prior to September 11th, we were largely a garrison-based army that lived to train. But we have been operating on a rotational cycle here with systems, institutional systems, that were designed to support that garrison-based army. It's like trying to put a square peg in a round hole. And so we are adapting our institutions so that we can put the whole army in a cycle so we can do this much, much more routinely than we're doing it. For the active force, we would break it down into four bins, four force pools. That's one out, three back. That I believe, is sustainable indefinitely. Our short-term goal is to get to one out 2 years back, and we hope to get there at the end of fiscal year 11 as we execute the drawdown in Iraq. Within each one of those bins, the Army could generate one operational headquarters, four tactical headquarters, 14 or 15 brigade combat teams, and about 75,000 enablers, artillery, engineers, civil affairs, psychological operations units, all of the different types of capabilities that units need to be successful. And the cycle would work so that you would always have one of those available. And that would almost but not quite meet the demand in Iraq and Afghanistan right now. You would have a second element that was through workups and in a ready phase where if you had an emergency someplace else, you would have a like force available. I would consider that force the operational reserve. Then you would have two more elements that would be in varying levels of readiness, preparing to come forward, that I would consider the strategic reserve. And you would have active guard and reserve all mixed into that formation. But the notion is we could generate a fairly substantial capability on a sustained basis with a hedge against uncertainty and do it in a way that's sustainable for the all-volunteer force. That, and within that mix, we would have, I said, a versatile mix of tailorable organizations. There would be some heavy forces, there would be some striker forces, and there would be some light forces mounted on Humvees and MRAPs to be able to operate in the environments that we're operating in. And that would allow us to generate options for the National Command Authority across the spectrum. And you could plug and play to take what you needed out of that. That is the direction that we are heading. And I suspect, as I said, our goal is to get to a 1 year out, 2 years back by the end of 11. And somewhere after that, I would like to be able to move us to a 1 year out, 3 years back, and get on that program. Someone asked me the other day, what is the most significant thing the Army would like to get out of the QDR? The most significant thing I'd like to get is an acceptance of that rotational model and the forces within that rotational model as a way forward. And I believe it is indeed a versatile mix of tailorable organizations that can generate a supply of trained and ready forces for full spectrum operations at a sustainable level for the all-volunteer force. That's broadly the direction that we're going. I'll just close here, and before I take your questions, with one point here. You get a lot of questions about the quality and how things are going. I'll just tell you, I've done two commissionings here in Washington. I did Georgetown and George Mason. Then I went up to West Point last week and gave an address to all of the cadets and their families the night before they graduated. And I'll just tell you, the country is in good shape when you look in the eyes of these young men and women. And I told them a story about one of their own who was in that dinner in 2007 when I spoke. And his name was Second Lieutenant Nick Esslinger. Nick was on a patrol in Samarra, Iraq. For me, it was with Samarra. Walking down a street, middle of the night, big high walls surrounding the courtyards. all of a sudden a grenade comes over the wall into the middle of the platoon. Realizing that his soldiers are in great danger, he dives on a grenade. The grenade doesn't go off. He has the presence of mind to reach down and throw it over the wall, and the grenade goes off. I said, "My God, what were you thinking when the grenade didn't go off?" He says, "I don't know. I just reacted." I said, "What were you thinking when it went off?" He said, "I don't know. I just reacted." But that's the type of men and women that we have among our junior officers today, and I'm pretty comfortable with the quality that we have in our Army. So with that, thanks. I'd be happy to take your questions.
You want me to take questions for you?
No, that's okay. I'll do it, unless you want to. Okay. Please. Mitzi.
I'm Mitzi Wirth. I'm with the Energy Conversation. I want to ask you about culture, because it seems to me one of the issues that we face today is understanding the enemy and being able to communicate with him. And when I was growing up, we had the National Defense Education Act, which I think there's snippets of that today. But is there any thought of reinstituting that so we can start developing the cultural knowledge from a vast number of people sort of covering the world? Anyway, I have a second question, if I can ask two. Last night I had dinner with Sherrod Cooper Coles, who is now Holbrooke's deputy but had been the ambassador in Afghanistan. And he asked me, "Why are we in Afghanistan?" And I said, "I didn't know, but I would ask you this afternoon."
Let's talk about culture. we've been doing an awful lot of work on culture, and we've learned an awful lot about culture. And what's interesting to me, it's not just us understanding their culture, it's understanding how they perceive us because of the way the culture that we bring to this. And it's interesting, I used to watch in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, the old three cups of tea. Well, the Americans kind of, okay, one cup of tea, let's go, let's get on and get down to business. And it took us a while to work our way through that. We're inculcating this into all of our schools, all of our non-commissioned officer education, all of our officer education, and all of our deployment preparations include great work at cultural training. I will tell you, nothing helps build levels of cultural understanding than the repeated deployment and the operating in those cultures. And we're, as I said, we're building a cadre of young leaders who are more and more at home in these other cultures now. We always can go a lot further on that. The other thing we got into was a big discussion about should we focus on cultural, broad level cultural training so that we can broaden cultural understanding, or focus on languages. And as we looked at it, we found we got more payoff out of focusing on cultural training to expand their knowledge of how to deal broadly with other cultures. And there's so many. Technology is making so many strides in terms of translation we're finding that can really help us in communicating.
Did you read that article about DARPA?
About who?
DARPA, their translation machine.
I know they're working on something. I didn't read the article. No, I haven't seen the article. I was at a Google. 4 or 5 months ago, and they said in 5 years you'll be able to read any document in any language that you want. Now, why are we in Afghanistan? That's a fair question. I would tell you we're in Afghanistan to help build a country and security forces that can secure themselves and be representative of the people so that we can deny that country as a safe haven for terror. And that, in my view, that is why we're there. And that country has been used as a safe haven once to attack us on our soil. It could, that could happen again if we don't bring the country and the security forces to a level where they can protect their own country. And that's why I believe we're there. Jeff?
Good to see you, sir. Thanks for your service, by the way. You have been quoted a lot in the last couple of days. I'm sorry, I'm Jeff McCausland. You've been quoted a lot in the last couple of days about your comments about forces in Iraq and Afghanistan post-2011.
Yeah.
Obviously, with your background, not only in your current job of generating forces, but 32 months in Iraq, I thought you ought to get the opportunity to expand on that because a lot of that's been pretty short. So how do you see that longer term? And how would you particularly talk about a residual force and conversations with the Iraqis in particular about how that might look post-2011?
Yeah. I mean, I generally said the same thing that I said to you all, that I believe that we are going to have a long-term sustained commitment in this war. And I believe that there will be a requirement for about 10 Army and brigades and Marine Corps regiments for a decade or so. Not necessarily just Iraq and Afghanistan, and I'm, as you suggested, Jeff. I'm fully aware and said repeatedly in my congressional testimony that we will execute the drawdown plan that has been agreed between our governments. And I don't think anyone knows what the security relationship and the force levels will be, if there are any, in Iraq at the end of 2011. I think that's very much to be determined. But we're in an era of persistent conflict, and we are preparing the Army to be able to execute a sustained commitment of about 10 brigades worldwide. I say that because I'm the Chief of Staff of the Army, not to make policy. And every time I say it, I always say, this isn't policy. This is an assumption I'm making to drive how we organize the Army. And so there was never any intention to make a policy statement at all. Please.
I'm Frank Sullivan, General. In your discussion of your four bins, I noticed that you talked about the Guard and Reserve as part of the strategic reserve. They've done a lot of deploying in the current situations in both Afghanistan, Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm just wondering, how do you see the role of the Guard and Reserve shifting over time with this vision that you have of rotation and so forth?
That's another great question, and it's another one that I'm not making policy on. But I mean, this is a question that probably needs some more national-level discussion, because we have come light years in moving the Guard and Reserve from basically a strategic reserve, where they were not very well manned and trained and equipped. They were held, you know, for the big one. And then you're going to throw the crank, and they were going to get spun out in divisions and go to Europe. As you suggest, that's not how we have been using them for the last 5 or 6 years. They are part of this force. And the way we talk about it is we have moved them from a strategic reserve to part of our operational force. Now, I mean, a real question I have in my own mind is, how long is that sustainable for the country? When you talk to the Guard and Reserve, the leaders, they don't want to go back. And what they tell us is, if you can get us to a 1 year out, 4 or 5 years back, that is sustainable. Now, I have no data to document that, but that's what they're telling us. And it's a significant concern, because we're preparing ourselves to include them in the rotational cycle. If I can't, and I still have the same level of requirements, that means that I need to have a larger active force. And so it's tied to that. But it's a discussion. I don't know what you feel, but I don't feel like we've had the discussion in the debate nationally about whether that's the way we want to continue. And we're just kind of going along. By the way, they're 45% of the Guard and Reserve are combat veterans. That's a fundamentally different army than 5 years ago. Please.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. NATO has an objective of 2% of GDP should go to defense spending. One of the few countries that's met that so far has been Britain. But Britain was just warned that it could lose its AAA bond rating, that's in jeopardy. The British will have to make cuts, and one of the areas that I'm reading where they'll have to make cuts is defense. I've heard that as much as a third of the defense budget may have to be cut. This would send shockwaves, I suspect, through the rest of NATO. If all the countries cannot meet their 2%, maybe go to 1.5% or below GDP, what capabilities would be available if you're talking about long-term commitments? And would that have an impact on us? Because in the financial press I'm reading, if Britain is in danger of losing its AAA bond rating, can the United States be far behind?
Yeah, I can't comment about the bond ratings. As you suggest, I don't know that very many NATO countries have met their 2% target over the history of NATO. I mean, it's been that way for a long time. I don't know the specifics of the British cuts. I'm actually going there in a couple of weeks to speak at their annual military conference, so I suspect I'll get an earful. Does that impact on the capabilities that they're able to provide? Sure, it does. How does that impact on us? Hard to say. But I mean, you know how hard Secretary Gates and the President have worked to get NATO countries to increase their contributions to Afghanistan. I mean, if there's less money available, there's probably, as you suggest, less contributions available. In the back.
Hi, General. John Donnelly with Congressional Quarterly.
John,
good
nice
to see you
again.
Yeah. The Quadrennial Defense Review is going to look at some pretty fundamental questions, one of which is whether the United States military should continue to prepare to fight two major combat operations in separated theaters. Do you personally believe that it's time for that particular construct to be changed? And has it unofficially already changed in the building of the fiscal 2010 budget?
Not that I'm overly sensitive, but again, in my role of not making policy, I'll comment on this. I absolutely do. And the reality of it is, John, with the amount of forces that we already have deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan, one of those MCOs is already kind of off the table. And one of the major things that we have discussed among the chiefs particularly is the need to change the force sizing construct, because we don't necessarily think that it's as relevant as it once was. And, you know, so what do you change it to? That's the hard part. And as I look at this, and I say, look, again, this is my belief, but if we think, and others think, that we're going to have about 10 Army brigades and Marine Corps regiments committed for a decade, one place or another, then why wouldn't we adopt that as reality scenario one? And then be able to do other things, assuming that those forces were committed. And so you have kind of one extended counterinsurgency effort, and then you have other things that you can do. As you suggest, this is one of the main topics that we have to get at in the Quadrennial Defense Review. What capabilities do the armed forces of the United States need to be able to jointly provide? And I think you're on the right one. I mean, I don't think anyone has said, certainly no one has said it's changed. But you know, the reality of the commitment is that we don't have ready forces available to do everything that we would like to do under a 2MCO scenario. Please.
Hi, Jeff Shogel with Stars and Stripes. With so much emphasis on counterinsurgency, is the Army prepared to fight and win a conventional war against North Korea?
Short answer is yes. It would probably take us a little bit longer to shift gears than we would like. And I've said publicly for some time, if we had to shift gears, it would probably take us about 90 days or so to shift our gears and to train the folks up that were preparing to go to Iraq and Afghanistan to go someplace else. The thing that allows me to say that is we have a combat seasoned force. You know, when I was growing up, we used to have to go to the combat training centers to learn how to fight. The young folks have been going to Iraq and Afghanistan. They're combat seasoned. And the mechanical skills of artillery gunnery and tank gunnery come back very, very quickly. The harder part is the integration. At really brigade level and above, of massing fires and effects in a very constricted period of time, as opposed to what you do in counterinsurgencies over a much longer and expanded period of time. But this is a tough combat season Army, and it can change gears just not as fast as we would like. With the format that I propose of the Army in the four bins, you'd have a four-division corps ready to go.
Just to see if I understand your answer correctly, are you saying if combat broke out on the Korean Peninsula, it would be at least 90 days before reinforcements could get there?
I'm glad you clarified that. We would move forces as rapidly as we felt they were trained and available. But don't think just about us. I mean, you have the best Air Force and the best Navy in the world that are you know, well within striking distance. As little as I want to say 2 or 3 months ago, we had the Third Corps go over and participate in the major Korean exercises there. So they're already trained in the skills that they need on that peninsula. So that's my answer to you.
Is that yes?
The answer is no. I mean, we move forces as rapidly as we could get them prepared. Please.
Brown, I'm at Homeland Security these days, sir. Good to see you.
Dallas, nice to see you.
In a related question, I'm curious as to your thoughts lately on the future of the heavy force and specifically the M1 tank.
I think the future of the heavy force is that we have invested in the tank and the Bradley to the point where they will be the dominant fighting vehicles in their categories for a while, for another decade or so. So I don't necessarily worry about that. One of the things we'll look at over the QDR as part of the force mix is, do we still need as many heavy brigades as we had? You know, we've already come down at 19 heavy brigades from where we were. And frankly, we're moving toward what I would call a more middleweight force. And the analogy is really a middleweight fighter is agile enough to punch up against heavyweights and to overcome lightweights. And so I think we'll probably even further downsize the heavy force over the next several years and replace it with some middleweight vehicles. But it's got a role in the Army for a while. Please, Mitzi.
I've been listening to the President a lot in the last few weeks, and he's always talking about energy and environment. What is the Army's position on energy and environment in the QDR?
We, like the other services, have been investing a lot of time and effort in trying to improve our energy efficiencies. We've got some hybrid cars out there that we're putting around on the bases. And we're actually starting to reap some of the benefits of that. And we have a broad Army energy strategy that we're implementing to continue to save money, leverage solar power and other different energy alternatives at our bases. The Secretary of the Army is leading that. I am a contributing player on that one. Please.
Sir, thanks for your comments today. Kevin Ryan. There were some disconnects during the run-up to the Iraq War between force providers and force users. We've got unified commands out there. Everybody has needs. Force providers know what they can put forward. Assuming that the R4 gen model and the number of brigades that the Army and the Marine Corps can put out there, even assuming that everyone agrees that that's the force that you have to draw from, there's still some potential for debate and back and forth between the ones who need forces and the ones who can generate them. Are we adjudicating that the right way today through this kind of coming through a global force management process, or should we empower the joint staff to be like a general staff making operational decisions? Are we set up right?
A couple things. The model I described is designed to, as I said, generate a versatile mix of tailorable organizations, because the one thing we know about the future is we're never going to get it quite right. And so you have to be able to put together packages of forces that meet the reality that really presents itself, not the one you designed it to do. And we believe the way we're organized in the Army will allow us to do that. Now, is the global force management process as it exists today the most effective way of managing those forces? Hard to say. Like anything else, it is a way. And by and large, through all the arm waving and everything that goes along with it, it does work, and it does generate the forces, trained and ready forces for the combatant commanders. So, I mean, you can argue whether GIFCOM ought to be doing it, whether the Joint Staff should do it, or whether the services can do it, and that's kind of one of these perpetual debates that goes around. But by and large, it is an effective way of providing the forces that the combatant commanders need to accomplish their missions.
So you're comfortable with that as the preferred?
For now, I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, there's no perfect system in the Department of Defense or probably in any organization. And you can always tweak it. But right now, it's doing an okay job of getting the forces to the people that need them. Steve?
Steve Flanagan from CSIS. Sir, since you just mentioned it, I wondered, in, as you look at the global force management process now, is that something you would like to see changes in over the course of the next several years, or is this talk of a second review?
I mean, on the grand scale of changes necessary in the Department of Defense, would I start there? No.
No.
There's enough other things that we need to do and get straight than starting on that one.
And somewhat related to that, I wondered, could you, and some of the earlier questions, could you describe in a little more detail the second element of your force structure that you talked about, the response force capabilities? Could you talk a little bit more how they'd be trained and equipped, and also how they would be ready to work with coalition partners?
Well, all of the elements in the four force pools would be trained for full spectrum operations, offense, defense, and stability operations. Which stability operations includes the capability of working with indigenous forces. And it's kind of interesting. In 2004, when we started the transition team model in Iraq, the conventional force really wasn't very comfortable working with indigenous forces. And we had to train ourselves to work effectively with the Iraqis. In fact, I had to get special forces to come down and help train some of the conventional forces to in the skills needed to work with the Iraqis. Over time, the conventional forces have gotten very, very good at that. In fact, I was just down at our Joint Readiness Training Center watching one of the brigades of the 82nd who's going to Afghanistan to do the training mission. And I asked them the question, all the battalion commanders and sitting around the table, and I said, are you comfortable that we'll be able to give you enough training so you can effectively accomplish this training mission? And he said, sir, this is what we've been doing for the last 3 years. And so there's a much greater skill set among the conventional forces to be able to do this. So that's embedded in what they're already doing. The second force pool would have been through workups, and they would be trained for a variety of missions. They said you had heavy forces. They would probably have missions on the higher end of the spectrum, the light and the striker forces probably more toward the center and lower ends of the spectrum. And the notion would be that if they had to go someplace, you'd always have all forces would be trained for full spectrum operations. Some would be optimized for specific points so they could go and make an immediate impact. Please. Hey, before you go, Ray, the other element is, in the first force pool, we're looking to give some of the brigades that aren't committed to mission, regional affiliations. So each of the regional combatant commanders would have a brigade that they could call on to do security force assistance in their area of operations over the course of that period. And that would allow the soldiers in the brigade to do the cultural training, to do the language training in that area. And we think that type of matchup is a great augmentation to what special forces are doing in the other regional combatant commands. Yep, those will continue. Ray.
Yeah, Ray Dubois, CSIS. Chief, you indicated that the Army today, as it is structured, and it's with its end strength of 550 minus active component, 350 guard, 200 plus in the reserves, could sustain over time, unknown, 10, 11 brigade combat teams in the field with an equivalent number of enablers. Even with the drawdown in Iraq, the plus up in Afghanistan, it would appear that we're going to have to sustain, at least for the next several years, a number higher than 10 BCTs. Does that imply that an end strength plus up is in order?
Not necessarily. And frankly, what happens is we actually increase our total number of deployed forces by about 10,000 over the next 6 to 8 months before it starts coming down with the drawdown in Iraq. And this is a pretty fundamental question for me that I wrestle with all the time. What's the right size of the Army? You know, we finished our growth. Originally, this growth was supposed to be done in 2012, and we finished it this year. That's a good thing. That's 1.1 million folks, about half in the active force, half in the Guard and Reserve. I believe that I ought to be able to design a fairly effective Army on a rotational cycle that can meet the needs of the nation within that 1.1 million number. Now, as I said, when we get that force built, put on that cycle, it doesn't quite meet the demand today. And so one of the questions, one of the debates we need to have in the QDR is, are we willing to accept a supply-based force rather than a demand-based force? And we're kind of doing it now for the Navy and the Marine Corps. No, you get X carriers on a rotational cycle. That's what you get. You want a surge, you get a bit more. But that's what you get. And that's the debate and the discussion we need to have. The challenge for all of us is the people costs. And you see the healthcare costs and the people costs just continue to go up. And if we are going to have a larger Army, in my view, I would like to be able to train it and to equip it and to give the soldiers and their families the quality of life that they deserve. And that's the real balance. And the bigger it is, the less money that's available to give them the equipment, the training, and the support that they need. That's the big question. And that's one of the, I think that's one of the major debates that we'll have within the QDR. Please. One behind you and then you. Okay. Go ahead.
Sir John Bonsall. A couple questions about personnel management. You talked about interagency. Is there any effort going on in DOD or in the Army to work soldiers into other agencies
yep.
into field units? That's the first part. Second part is the two brigades you have back here in sort of a, hate to use the word tiered readiness. I know that brings up bad connotations. I don't mean it that way, but in a different readiness status than those that are operationally deployed. Are those units at 100%? Or are they in some lesser percentage of fill?
You said the two units or just the
two? You have four force pools?
Oh, yeah, the two pools. Okay.
Yeah, the two other pools. And finally, have you addressed any stop loss in this new plan so that when that brigade goes out there, or the one getting ready to go, that we don't have to employ that to try to keep those forces 100%?
Our goal all along has been when we get to this rotational model that we are able to deploy a cycle without stop loss. And you saw the Secretary announced a few months ago that we're coming off a stop loss, starting with the reserves in August, Guard in September, and us on the 1st of January. And what that means is units that deploy after those dates will deploy without stop loss, and it'll gradually work itself out by the end of 11. But that has been our objective all along, and that's another reason why it's important that we get on this cycle so that we can line our school systems up so that they produce people to go into these units, and we're not constantly having to pull people from all over. And so we can deploy without stop loss. What you see in these bins, the available bin is fully manned, trained, and equipped. The second bin is manned at a C1 level, so about 90% or better. The next level, the train level, is manned at about 80%, manned and equipped about 80% or better, sufficient for them to do their workups. And then in the reset, which is the last bin, they basically are not ready at all, and they're breaking up, going off to schools and doing things, and then they come back together after about a 6 month period, and they get gone for their workups. So it is a cyclical readiness model that gradually improves as they get closer to the availability. And what was your first question? Oh yeah, good. Bill Caldwell, who runs our Fort Leavenworth for us, has worked a very good deal with the State Department, where they send young foreign service officers out to go through Fort Leavenworth, which is our majors level school. And to help them out, we send Army folks back to fill their jobs while they come and do that. The other thing, I mean, he's worked a bunch of these initiatives with the agencies, and we have a pre-command course that I go out and talk to every month, whether lieutenant colonels and colonels and their spouses. And I'm sitting there, and I'm looking in this row, and there's these four big guys with their arms crossed and short haircuts, and I'm saying to my, you know, I went up to them afterward and said, hi, did your bags get lost? And they said, no, we're the CIA. So, we're bringing folks into the pre-command courses as well. And, I mean, Bill Caldwell's all over this, and he realizes what we all realize, is that the sooner you get started with the interagency connections, the better off you're going to be. And we only want to do more of that stuff.
Hi, Amy Green from Arctic Forward, and I was wondering what you anticipate and would like to see the FCS program look like in the future, given the Secretary's recent announcement, and if there's anything the Army could or should have done to have helped the Secretary reach a different decision.
Oh, okay, good question. And I've said this publicly many times here over the course of my congressional hearings, but, I mean, Secretary Gates gave us every opportunity to make our case. I went back to him three times. And the fundamental issue was I could not convince him that we had done enough to incorporate the lessons of the current fight into the manned ground vehicle as it was. And I felt we had a better 80% solution. He didn't think that was enough. And that was the fundamental disagreement, and he made his decision. Now, that said, the only element of the SCS program that is canceled is the manned ground vehicle. All the rest of the program, the pieces of the network, and the what we call the spinouts, that's all moving forward. And instead of just going to 15 brigades, it's going to the whole every brigade in the Army, which is a much better thing. The other aspect of it was that the Secretary is committed to the development of a ground combat vehicle to replace the Bradley, and maybe ultimately the tank. And he has said publicly and to me privately that he has fenced the money for that. And we have our training and doctrine command that you work for working on a new development document, and we're looking for that document after Labor Day, and we'll move forward. We have put ourselves on a timeline to field a vehicle in 5 to 7 years. And we do that consciously knowing that really ties us to existing technology. But we think that's okay because we know where the state of the art of technology is for combat vehicles, because we've pushed there with the Future Combat System program. And so we will be able to capture that technology and incorporate it into a vehicle. It's not like where we started, in the early 90s, where the technology was zip, and we actually built it up to where we are now. So I think we're on a good track for this. Now, what could we have done differently? You can bet that when we finish, the program, when the acquisition decision memorandum gets issued here in a couple of weeks from the department, the program will get broken up into several of its pieces. You can bet we're not going to come up with another program that's $150 billion. I can tell you that for starters. The second thing is, frankly, we designed a program that was really very good, but we could not explain it. And we spent more time explaining the program to people unsuccessfully than we did actually working on the program. And at the end, that doesn't help you. So whatever we come up with is going to be simpler. The last thing I'd say is we have learned an awful lot out of that. And the network and the spin-outs and all those things, those are going to be going into the force late 11, early 12. And that's about 3 years ahead of where we thought we'd get them in there. And they will make a decided difference in this environment and really in any environment that we go into. One more over here. And then, Frank, I'll come back to you for the last question.
Hi, Megan Scully with Congress Daily. Just wanted to follow up. You'd mentioned it wouldn't be $150 billion. When you add up the sum total, though, of the three programs or four programs FCS will divide into, do you see that Do you see the manned ground vehicle portion still costing the $87 billion or whatnot?
I can't say. I mean, the manned ground vehicle will clearly be the most expensive part of the program. There's no doubt about that. How much it will cost, I couldn't even venture a guess because we haven't even come up with a design yet. Okay, two more then, Frank. Go ahead.
Military.com. You spoke about Hezbollah in Lebanon 2006. I'd just be curious to hear your take on what you would do differently confronted with that challenge, with that operational and tactical challenge that the IDF faced.
Well, I mean, if you look at the Israelis' own after-action reviews of that conflict, it wasn't necessarily the tactics that they applied at the time. But what you hear mostly from them is that they were working so much, in the West Bank and conducting counterinsurgency-like operations that they lost their combined arms skills, the ability to integrate fires in air and tanks and artillery, that's where they really when they critiqued themselves, that's what they told themselves. And if you look at what they just did in Gaza, where they employed combined arms, and I think as they do their after-action review of that, they will see that actually helped them. And a lot of folks think that as was asked over here, is the heavy force dead? And you know, the heavy force isn't dead, and then you see the value of a heavy force in places like Gaza. I saw it firsthand in Najaf and in Fallujah. And in urban combat, tanks and Bradleys are very, very effective. So that's why I say you need a mix of forces that you can tailor and use both at the strategic level and at the tactical and operational levels. So that's kind of what I'd say on that question. Frank, you get the wrap-up.
Just coming back to your four bins, General, two somewhat related questions. Do you see a need, or do you see a a change in the way the Army is organized, given the four bins that you're talking about? And secondly, you've said you've got the manpower for it. Like, what are your sort of top two or three challenges in getting to the objective you're trying to get to?
I'm sorry, I lost your first question. I was focused on your second one.
Changes in Army organization.
Yeah. I said versatile mix of tailorable organizations. Now, we have been moving to modular organizations since 2004. And I mentioned that we had converted about 85% of our 300 brigades to modular organizations. And these are organizations that are designed to operate in any environment, and they're designed to be tailorable to whatever type of mission you might go to. And so that organizational change is already well on its way. In fact, it's almost finished. And also, it includes tailorable packages of enabling forces, and again, aviation, artillery, civil affairs, those kinds of things, that can be added to these modular organizations, again, for whatever the mission is. So, I mean, that's a significant organizational change for us. You might remember we were a division-based army. We had 18 divisions, and all of the enablers were inside the division. So if you wanted to deploy something less than a division, you had to break the division apart. Now you can deploy these modular brigades with much greater facility. The manning challenges. The greatest manning challenge that I have right now is we have a lot of what I'll call non-distributable manpower. We have about 10,000 soldiers who are in warrior transition units or running warrior transition units. We have about 10,000 soldiers who are already deployed, who are serving in headquarters in Iraq and Afghanistan in provincial reconstruction teams or on training teams. And then we have another 10,000 or so that are temporarily non-deployable. So roughly, that's about 30,000 people that aren't available to go into units. And that's making it more and more difficult for me to man those units. Now, probably the thing that worries me most as I look over the next 12 to 24 months are the long-term impacts of the repeated combat deployments on the health of the force. In 2008, we had 13,000 or so folks identified new cases of post-traumatic stress. That's good news, bad news. I mean, that's a lot. It's about double what it was 2 years before. But the good news is more and more people are willing to come forward to get help, and we've got a concerted effort to do that. In next month, we will be rolling out a program that we call Comprehensive Soldier Fitness. And it is designed to raise mental fitness to the same level that we give to physical fitness. And it's designed to increase soldiers, to give them the skills to increase their resilience and enhance their performance. Because, you know, we're reacting to the increase in suicides and some of the other stresses we see because of the impacts on the mental health of the force. But we felt we had to do something on the preventive side if we're going to get there. And last week I was up at University of Pennsylvania, where I had about 50 sergeants and civilians that were going through a class taught by the University of Pennsylvania on resilience trainers. And these folks will become our master resilience trainers. And we will put them down into every battalion so that they can assist the soldiers in building resilience. The other part of the program will be an assessment tool that soldiers can do online. And it's a self-help tool. They'll get feedback. They'll answer a bunch of questions, and they'll get feedback on what their level of mental fitness is. And then it will connect them to different modules that can help them out. And then we'll add training modules at every level of Army education in the deployment cycle. So it's a fairly comprehensive program designed to raise our focus on mental fitness to prevent some of these injuries before they happen.
Thank you very much.
Listen, thank you all very much. It's been great to chat with you.
Thank you. This is a seat for you in the back, or you can go upstairs.
Okay.
If you want to walk upstairs.
I want to watch Tom Shanker. Come on in.
Sorry, we're going to try and move quickly to the panel and not take an official break in order to get to some of the key issues. Hey, Bruce. Sit down. We're getting started here. All right, good to see you. All right, we'll get started. Let me start by introducing our moderator, Tom Shanker. For the last 8 years, Tom has served as the Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times. And in that capacity, he's embedded with both general purpose and special forces at all levels in both Iraq and Afghanistan, along with a wide variety of other reporting responsibilities. He joined the Times in 1997 as the paper's assistant Washington editor, responsible for its coverage of foreign policy, national security, and economics. Prior to joining the Times, Mr. Shanker, he's a super guy. He's going to do a great job with our panelists, and we're really happy to have him here. Thanks very much.
Thank you. In essence, I have the easiest job here. I'm simply the maitre d' for a full course discussion and assessment of General Casey's comments. And I think just I'll very quickly introduce the folks who are going to speak with you here. John Watson is an Army veteran and now is with the House Armed Services Committee. When I asked him whether he was on the majority or the minority staff, he said he's a recovering majority staff member. Valerie Baldwin is a principal of Baldwin Consulting, a firm that specializes in providing government relations services. And lastly, we have Kim Wincup, Senior Vice President at Science Applications International Corporation. My younger son loves palindromes. I love the fact that SAIC is CIA's. With that, John? Oh, sure. We'll just move down the row here.
Okay, just a couple quick comments before we move on. My first disclaimer that I have to say, I think I'm the only one up here that's still actively on the Hill, so obviously I have to do the disclaimer that says that these are my own personal views and opinions and obviously aren't the official views of the House Armed Services Committee. And I say that because even though I am in the majority, I still like my job and I would like to keep it. I think overall, at the very top level, from a congressional perspective, and I know there'll probably be some questions, and the other panelists will comment on some of Secretary Gates' comments. I think from a congressional perspective, you know, overall, you know, should a reform budget precede a QDR? These are things that I think members are struggling with, not necessarily that they're disagreeing with the direction that the Secretary has stated. And within that, you know, where is the analysis that supports some of the decisions that the Secretary has made? Again, it's not an issue even so much of the programs, although certainly has been, you know, reported, many members and senators have talked about individual programs. It really, I believe, the fundamental issue or concern as we get ready to go through the QDR is that given what has just happened, you know, what has significantly changed in the world since the last QDR in terms of, you know, requirements, capabilities, and gaps that led to those decisions of those specific programs. And I think sometimes the discussion on that issue, you know, General Casey talked about kind of, you know, misunderstanding things. And I think while clearly there are parochial issues that come up, I think, again, the fundamental issue that Congress is struggling with or has struggled with and will continue to struggle with is what is the basis of that. I think so far we've heard a lot about specific weapon systems and about, you know, Cold War weapons and all those kinds of things. But I think they have a valid concern about what, you know, what has changed in the world. And as we get ready to do this QDR, you know, I mean, in its simplest form, you know, what does our country need our military to do? I mean, that's the starting point. And then once you figure that out, you know, what are the threats that, you know, the military is going to face? Based upon those threats and the current military we have, what are the gaps? And based on those gaps, you know, can we use NATO partners? Do we need to change TTPs or force structure, as General Casey's talked about? Or do we need to develop new weapon systems or modernize current systems? And so I think, although, you know, there's always discussion about particular weapon systems, and that will continue, I think, again, the fundamental issue is the basis of those changes, the requirements, the threats, and the gaps. Specifically from the Army, I think, again, as General Casey talked, I mean, the Army is doing so much right now in terms of fighting two wars. You know, they're deployed or forward stationed in over 80 countries. They're modernizing. They're moving from the strategic reserve to an operational reserve. They're resetting. They're doing all these things. And it's, you know, it's with that backdrop that we look at the 2010 budget. As some would say, I think John mentioned, you know, has the QDR already happened? But as we look at the 2010 budget request, as it pertains to the Army, MILPERS is up, which is a very good thing. Procurement's down, R&D's down, resets down, even UFERS are down. I mean, what does that mean? I think it's too early to tell right now. But, I mean, from a congressional perspective, I believe those are some fundamental questions that that the members at all levels will be asking. And with that, I'll just close and move on.
Thanks.
Maybe what I'll do is actually build a bit on what John said, because I think when you think about what the chief said today, he needs to have about four bins of 10 brigades each that are in various states of readiness. The first bin needs to be at a high level of readiness. The second one needs to be about 90%. And then the next two, which he considers the strategic reserve, have a lesser degree of readiness. So then in my, for me, the question is, has the FY10 budget already decided what those levels of readiness are? Effectively, and if you consider what the out-year budgets for the Department of Defense look like, and at least at this point the projections are that the budgets stay flat or a modest increase, then the question is, are we at a point where that force mix that the chief talks about is the right force mix but without the right equipment, without the right amount of training? I think that would be a very big part of what QDR needs to decide. If you look at the Army's budget, as John said, MILPERS is up, and that is excellent. It went up by about $6 billion. If you look at the offsets, however, the offsets came about $3.5 billion out of the procurement accounts, And if you look at the O&M account, it's relatively flat. But if you consider that in the budget request is also a 2.9% pay hike for civilian employees, then the accounts and civilian employees make up the vast majority of the O&M account, then the question I would have is, well, what has the impact been then on your maintenance and repair accounts? What has the impact been on your op tempo accounts, which is how where the Army builds in all its training scenarios and events? So have we effectively diminished the capability to adequately train the force? Have we also diminished their capability to have the right mix of weapons? And again, that will all have to be considered in QDR. One of the things that we talk about, I think all of us up here have talked about the fact that QDR is oftentimes it's supposed to be a strategic exercise. It usually boils down to a budget exercise, and then the strategy backs into the budget. I think that is another real concern, and I think we need to, the folks running QDR are going to have to manage that potential challenge. I think that also the most important part, I think one of the most important, one of the biggest challenges that QDR is going to face is that they create an army that has the right force mix and the right number of people in it, but that it is hollow in terms of its capability. And this was a question that was raised in the last QDR. It was a question raised in the QDR before that. And I think that in this current strategic environment, that would be if in fact that is the direction that we go, how do you mitigate that risk? And have we actually, does the QDR have a good handle on how to mitigate that risk? They've talked about ISR. They've talked about getting a good handle on the force structure, on the cost of the force, and then how that would bear on whether or not they have a better, faster, cheaper vehicle and vehicle mix. They've talked about more special operations forces. And I guess the question in my mind is, if you have an army that is not as capable as would be required, then how do you mitigate that risk outside of the army?
Thank you very much. Well, thanks. I'll be short, both because I'm last and because Frank Sullivan and Ted Stroop are in the room, and I'm sure that I'll get critiqued substantially for whatever I say, so I'll just accept that. Say, first of all, to Marin and Tom, I think the title of this conversation is right, because the Army in a period of persistent conflict is the right question. On the kinetic side, it's remarkably effective and agile, but I think the conflict they face now is on the budget side, and that's where the Army has not been very successful relative to other services. And I think it's unfortunate, but it's been that has been persistent over time. And I will just offer a couple reasons why it seems to me that may be the case. The Army doesn't seem to have the same constituency that the other services do, both in the building and on the Hill. They have fewer programs that seem to create constituencies, which can be important to them. And secondly, those fewer programs give them less money to move around. With a large personnel account that basically all spends in the first year, there's just not a lot of flexibility in their budget, so it's a tough place to manage. And I would say, maybe less charitably, but that I think too often some of the leaders in the Army have been less willing than the other services to mix it up in the both in the building and on the Hill in the so-called political environment or the budget environment. I'm not comfortable saying that. I feel it's too bad because the Army happens to be my favorite service, but I've seen it for a long time. I think the impact's going to be that for the reset of the force with the huge capital costs that they're facing over time, both for the Guard and Reserve and for the active side, that the cuts are going to come on the active duty part of the Army. I think it's inevitable. I think the Army will, we've seen this happen in the past, the Army will be the one that'll
offer those up when the pressure mounts. And I suspect the QDR won't posit forces of the size that would, for a long period of time, that would allow the Army to sustain an argument for a larger amount of money. Now, I personally don't think that's necessarily a bad thing because the reserves can fill in. At a 4-to-1 ratio in terms of cost, and with the combat experience with the chief, which the chief mentioned, plus kind of the benefits you get in an all-volunteer environment of a large reserve component, I think that happens to be a good thing. The problem, of course, and the really hard issue to work in this is the one he mentioned, is this rotational model and how that works with the RC going forward, and which is something that everyone needs to determine. It's worked remarkably well, probably unpredictably well so far, but it's a very tough problem for the Army and the country to work going forward. So I'll stop at that time.
Thank you very much. It's always hard to grade the homework of an Army Chief of Staff, but I think the three panelists done it with great insight and grace, and I thank you. I have a couple of questions to start off our discussion. After that, I hope it will be in the form of a discussion with everyone here. All of you have talked about it. General Casey mentioned it, but I guess the reporter in me simply wants to ask the question directly. Is the Army big enough, and does it need to grow? I mean, he's talking about the force over the next year will deploy more to the CENTCOM AO than is now. And he's saying, I wish, I hope, maybe we'll get to 1-to-2 by 2012, maybe beyond that better. I don't think that optimism has ever been a very good planning paradigm. Does the Army need to be bigger?
More on the hardware side, but I'll take a stab at it. I mean, that's a very important question. You know, I think as we look back, I mean, I can remember back about 2004 when former Chief General Schoomaker testifying as, you know, at least on the House Armed Services Committee, the end of the 90s and then the early 2000s, both at the time Chairman Hunter and Ranking Member Skelton were very supportive and were pushing the administration, both administrations, the Clinton administration and then the soon-to-be Bush administration, on increasing in strength. And I specifically remember General Schoomaker's hearing when they were basically going down that line of questioning to him, and he basically said, look, I need time to look at that. I'm the new chief of staff, but I believe we're probably going to need about 77 to 82 BCTs, and this is about the 2004 timeframe. Then, of course, the QDR came out, and it was down to 70 BCTs. And then 2 years ago, the department comes back and says we need 76 BCTs, and, oh, by the way, we need to accelerate those BCTs. And now, with the 2010 submit, we see we need 73 BCTs. So, I think it's a very good question. I don't have a good answer for that. I mean, obviously, it kind of depends on the deployment stuff, but I
I guess my answer is I think that question will be supply-driven, and that will be resources. I don't think there are enough resources to grow the Army, the active Army, any further than it is today. I think we were stretching the recruiting environment as it was, taking in folks that you might not have chosen to do on other occasions with some of the waivers that went on. Obviously, they're moving away from that. But I think the pure budget circumstances are such that there's just not going to be enough money to do it.
Led into the next question very nicely, which I thank you. Those of us who had to cover the House Armed Services Committee hearing on the budget with Gates and Mull, and it was 5 hours of sitting in our chairs, and the only really great moment of drama was when the recovering majority member, Mr. McHugh, you know, turned to the secretary and pinged him directly on this question of how can you bring us a budget that you say is so transformational. We haven't seen the QDR or the strategic underpinnings. And we've had so much debate today about whether the military should have its force planning based on supply side or demand side. I guess putting aside the obvious, I mean, won't we always only be able to fit a strategy that we can pay for? And isn't it time our government and our military leaders said, give us the money, we'll buy the stuff, then we'll tell you the strategy?
I started first last then.
I'll take a stab at that. The fact of the matter is that the Department of Defense has the largest budget in the federal. They have more than 50% of the total federal appropriations. Growing that to meet the strategy, I think,
is something that the country is probably not particularly ready for, particularly now. And I would also say that there's a very good question about whether or not that's a good policy or not, and it certainly is not something that should be decided by the Department of Defense. That's a national policy that needs to be driven by the President and the United States Congress. But having said that, there is a very good question about what it costs to run the Army and every other service component. And I believe that the Department of Defense is attempting to get their arms around this issue. We know what it costs to send a battleship into the fight. We know what it costs to send a wing into the fight. We don't know what it necessarily costs to send a brigade into the fight. And for me, a brigade is as much a platform, a combat platform, as as part of the fleet or as part of an air wing. So if you consider that, if you understand what the costs are of the various service components, and then you figure out what money you've got, then perhaps you can develop a strategy that is reasonable based on the available funds that you've got. And the question that I think the Army was asking 2 years ago, and it's the same question that they're asking today, is you want us to be ready, you want us to be ready to meet the major combat in the last QDR, it was 2 MCOs. Now we're changing that a bit. But the fact of the matter is the budget questions have not changed since then. And so the bigger question for me is, okay, let's figure out what we've got to. I guess now I'm going to put my former appropriator hat on. You're given a top line. You're told to appropriate to that top line and to create a strategy that works the best. Based on what we know about the current and future threats.
One last question before I turn it over to the audience to question our panel of experts, and this is also in the category of trying to bring the emperor to the correct haberdasher. Gates has put a budget out there that he and his staff have described, not as transformational, because that's a word of the prior administration, but as very significant in shifting the focus. Yet he also says 50% is for traditional combat, 40% is dual use for the new wars and the old wars, and only 10% is really a shifting of resources. So despite all of the dust that's been kicked up over weapons programs and all of that, how big a change is this budget proposal?
I can't speak to the budget proposal piece of it, but I was struck by the chief's comments when he described the world that he is creating an army for. That I thought, was transformational from what we've heard in the past. And so I think the words are certainly starting to, that the Secretary of Defense has been pushing, are starting to show up in what will obviously be the planning process that goes with it.
I mean, I guess my only comment would be, in General Casey kind of touched on it, and Secretary Gates and Admiral Mullins is also, you know, when they look at this, you know, where's the knee in the curve as you're going down the path that we're going down, whatever that is, in terms of funding a so-called conventional force and you know, a regular warfare force. I think that, you know, hopefully you would think that would be where the QDR would come out. And one thing that concerns me, and I think, you know, Congress will concern Congress, is you hear this buzzword, acceptable level of risk. And I think whatever path we go down, you know, Congress has the right to understand, you know, that shouldn't be a bumper sticker. They really need to understand what that, you know, what that means, because, you know, they have the congressional or the, you know, constitutional responsibility to stand up and supply the Army. So.
Okay, thank you. I invite questions from the audience. Anyone with a thought to share or a question for this esteemed panel? Yes, sir.
Tom, I'm Ted Stroop, and I want to answer your question. And, of course, I'm a little proponent in terms of advocacy. The Army's not large enough, and the Department of Defense and the Congress are going to be faced, as they are at the end of every budget cycle or the submission of every budgetized QDR, of guns versus butter. It's how much force structure, how much modernization, how much maintenance and readiness training do you want, versus quality of life and number of soldiers and taking care of families. One of the things that's never mentioned in the debate is the size of the providing force. If you look upon the chief's four bins as being a barnyard, and you look at those four bins being different levels of animals in the developmental stage, you still got to have a farm and a bunch of farmers and farm workers to take care of those four bins. The Army simply doesn't have enough people in that, those four bins in the providing force to maintain it. Your Army leadership, civilian and military, will always generate enough folks to be in those four bins, whether it's Cold War bins or General Casey's current bins. And what gets neglected is both the military and the civilian force in that providing portion of the barnyard. I testified in 96, said the Army was stressed and strained as we looked at going into the Balkans. Nothing's changed. We're just in a different place and we're in an active war.
Right. Well,
That's my answer to your question.
And that certainly takes the metaphor of the day award. Thank you so much. anyone else? I welcome your thoughts, questions for our panel. Yes.
Let me think of how to say this.
Directly.
Is the, I will, the, is the panel's opinion, and I'd like to sort of hear the whole panel talk about this a little bit, on the margin, is the QDR worth doing? Let me go back and say that the Secretary of Defense has issued a fairly interesting, fairly well-received vision document a number of months ago. He has issued a series of programmatic decisions that are pretty sweeping and pretty broad. I think everybody's agreed, it sounds like everybody's fairly well agreed, the budget's not going to change dramatically in one direction or another. It's going to be about where it is. So my question is, on the margins, is it worth doing?
Panelists?
Well, I guess my first comment would be, this isn't my quote. It's I think it actually comes from the budget world. Maybe Valerie knows. But, you know, a vision without resources is a hallucination. You know, well, you know that's when you mention the vision word. I mean, I guess if it from a congressional perspective, if it gets the members, you know, the information and the analysis in terms of peeling back that onion and defining what is an acceptable level of risk, then yes, it's worth it. I think another question would be, is, you know, that law has been on the books for a while now. I mean, are there things that need to happen to change the construct of the QDR and how it happens? Do we need another national defense panel or something like a national defense panel? I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe that's another question.
Just one thought, if I could, before I let the other panelists speak. It would seem smarter, and to answer both of these problems, if the QDR remained quadrennial but was not timed with that other great quadrennial event called the presidential election.
I think the QDR is an interesting intellectual exercise. It keeps a lot of people in the E-ring very busy and potentially, in my opinion, takes a lot of time away from putting what is the real driver of the Department of Defense, and that's the budget. It takes a lot of time away from that particular exercise. Now, having said that, I thought that the issues the Chief raised today were extremely relevant. What I'm concerned about or what I'm frustrated by, and having been in the building during the last QDR, I find it interesting that the questions have really not changed anymore because the answers continue to be driven by the realities of the budget. And they continue to be driven by the tranches of dollars, the traditional tranches of dollars that have gone to the service components. So if you look at that and you ask the question, is QDR an interesting exercise? I say, let's do it in a couple months. Let's get those interesting intellectual questions out there. Let's chat about them, and then let's let folks get back to the real important duties they have of the day.
Well, Frank, I guess speaking of bins, former appropriators' view of the world, and I'll give the former authorizers' view of the world. Actually, I do think it's worth doing, particularly because it's in the four-year term, and I think this, you know, a new administration wants to put some new spins on the world and how we're looking at it. I think this is the way they do it.
I suspect energy will be one thing we'll see a lot more interest in the department than we've seen in the past, among other things that are out there. So I think it's a useful exercise, personally, even though the budget, of course, is the operating document. But the other piece of it is I think it takes a while to turn the ship, and this is one of the ways the secretary and the new administration uses to turn the ship.
One thing I should just add, I actually believe that if, in fact, the budget and the QDR were married up, then I think it would be a phenomenally useful exercise. But there seems to be a significant gap between the outcome of what they decide during QDR and the budget outcome.
And only because it's an Army event, I'll quote from the retirement speech of General Shinseki, which is one of the greatest pieces of military rhetoric ever. He said, "Beware a 12-division strategy based on a 10-division Army." Jeff?
Yeah, I kind of like the comment before about, you know, what the chief had to say. And the fact that, thanks very much. And the fact that how he described the world. And what I thought was interesting was, of course, this whole idea of the reality scenario. Let's wake up and smell the reality. As we do scenarios, let's wake up and lay down a marker, which is what I heard him say. And the marker was 10 to 14 brigades are going to be somewhere, irrespective of whatever else happens in the world. North Korea goes crazy, or Cuba goes pear-shaped, or whatever. That's just a marker down on the table. It seems to me, and General Stroupper, somebody who's probably knows the numbers by heart, but if you go back through history as this tranche of the numbers, we had these struggles, but if you look at the percentages of the budget, it all stayed about the same. You know, the Army and the Navy and the Air Force all got about 28 to 30% of the budget, and the Marines got a few bucks on the side. And that's the way it was. But we all had enemies that could define our existence in great ways. As we all know, in 2001, a QDR was going on in September, in which we were going to make a big turn to look at the one thing I didn't hear the chief say. I never heard the phrase peer competitor, state peer competitor mentioned. If it was mentioned, please remind me. But if I listen to other chiefs, I hear that brought up. So my question is, are we perhaps this time going to actually see a real debate amongst the services on real trade-offs? And it's not a lot of, you know, flurry, but at the end of the day, it's 28% versus 32%, and we all march along.
Well, again, just one thought on that. He sort of addressed it to Jeff Shogle's question on the Korea contingency. He sort of said, I mean, he backed away from saying what I think we all heard him say, which is that's not a land war anymore. And so the Navy and the Air Force are first in, and thank you very much. And so that 90-day window didn't seem to trouble him, because if a war in Korea goes 90 days, the world as we know it is going to be very different. So I don't know, panelists, any other?
Okay, I mean, I guess I really am truly showing my true colors today, so you guys, former authorizers, be sure to chime in. It's my experience that once you have a budget baseline set, changing it only happens on the margins. Now, it can happen coming out of the Department of Defense, but at least when I was an appropriator, we didn't make a whole lot of major changes in the appropriate once it arrived in the United States Congress. So I would say if there is going to be a discussion of trade-offs, then I guess I'm wondering how are they going, and let me just also paint put a little bit more granularity on that question. April 6 was a fairly watershed event, and there was a lot of trade-offs, if you want to call them that, announced by the Secretary of Defense. As I understand it, all service components are backing into those decisions right now. If you look at the timeline, the first budget submission that the service components provide to the Department of Defense and the Office of Management and Budget will happen in about September. And the POM will also be developed over the summer. So if you consider that the Department of Defense has said that QDR is going to inform the FY11 and budget and the FY11 to 15 POM, then the question I've got is how many more trade-offs can the service components actually take effectively and work into a budget request? I would say the trade-offs are done, and now they are figuring out how to make those trade-offs work as a strategy.
I think I would only add that I agree. But if you're looking for an indicator about how successful the Army is going to be or is, you know, take a look at how successful the Army was in migrating supplemental funds back into the base budget.
If I could take the liberty of rephrasing Jeff's question, the weeks we were classmates in grad school together, he asked about near-peer competitors and why the chief didn't talk about them. And I guess when you look at what the Army does today, Iraq was not a near-peer competitor. Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were not near-peer competitors. Could the panelists tell me what is the near-peer competitor for which the Army and the ground forces have to prepare? And, Jeff, I invite an answer from you as well.
I mean, near-term competitor, I mean, you're talking from a conventional perspective or any perspective?
Right. I mean, as the chief said, you know, I'm trying to model on reality. Realistically speaking, is there a near-peer competitor that's going to be an Army fight? And I guess since we're all struggling here, the answer is kind of pushing toward no.
Well, I think the question also, though, you can't really answer that question with the today answer. I think you have to say under what time frame. Mm-hmm. Within 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. I think obviously if you look at China and what they're putting into the deep water Navy, and they're spending a lot of money on amphibious assault capabilities actually right now, so much so that I think even Japan is starting to put more funding towards some sort of amphibious assault capability. It's having a ripple effect. I think when people have that conversation or that debate, it's easy to get trapped into, you know, today or next week or the next year. I think the bigger question is looking 3, 4, 5, 10 years.
Kim, I see you eager to jump into this.
Well, I guess, Tom, to the extent I'm willing to, I'd go back to what your profession talks about, because they're always looking for kind of the chinks over in the building, and I think they have certainly pointed out that the planning for the China-like competitor is seems to be going by the wayside to a degree, mm-hmm. And I was struck by the lack of the reference in the chief's comments mm-hmm. today.
All right, thank you. Yeah, just...
Okay, so most forecasts show or indicate that 2010 budget will be kind of the high water mark for defense spending for both maybe the near term and the long term. We're kind of at the zenith of what spending will occur within the Department of Defense. So if that comes to pass as we might expect in 2011 and 12, informed by the QDR, what risk does that present to the Army? Specifically, that General Casey may or may not already be factoring in as he looks to build his program and deploy forces, take care of families, the bins, the whole gamut.
Well, I mean, a couple of things that come to mind. I mean, you know, the chief always talks about or has, you know, 2 years ago when he I think the first time he testified, he talked about his strategic initiatives where he kind of rolled out his "the Army's out of balance" speech, and he continues to talk about that. And he was asked this question at the HASC hearing in terms of, does this budget support, you know, your path to getting the Army back in balance? I think when he first laid it out, you know, it would take 3 or 4 years, so the 2011-2012 time frame. I think what's likely going to happen is that, at least from the HASC perspective, there isn't going to be any support for a decrease in strength, obviously. And so really the only other place you have to go is procurement. It gets back into, you know, the chief's question of, if this is what I'm going to have, I want to make sure they're properly equipped. And I think that's the risk. I think the risk is, will they be properly equipped? Will we have another, chief of staff 10 years from now testifying, saying he's got a $56 billion holes in the yard?
I agree completely with what John said. I think when I left the Army staff in 2006, we had a huge readiness issue. And the readiness problems were caused because we simply didn't have the equipment ready to go to give to the brigades who were back home getting trained up, ready to go back into the box and into the fight. I think at that point, there was a decision made that the Army would need $18 billion a year for the next 3 or 4 years, maybe 5, Nelson.
Okay, 3 years.
After hostilities
ceased, just to reset the force. If you look at the FY10 budget, O&M is flat, and yet there is a 2.9% increase for pay of civilians. So what that says to me immediately is that RESET is in trouble. RESET is in trouble. And so, again, I come back to if the budget is actually driving this QDR, then what are the risks of basically retreating to the past where we have a hollow force, and how do you intend to mitigate that? And what I have heard from the administration, from the policy people, is that they're going to look at ISR. They're going to look at more special operations. And the question in my mind is that sufficient? We have found that boots on the ground is the way to win in Iraq and in Afghanistan.
I just quickly add to that, because that reminded me, is in terms of RESET, like Valerie said, the chief and secretary, they came, they said they needed about $18 to $19 billion, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, $18 to $19 billion a year for RESET. RESET, of course, is a combination of O&M and procurement, those numbers. This year's budget, when you look at O&M procurement, RESET's $11 billion, still all in, I guess we call it now, the OCO, the Overseas Contingency Operation. So at a time where we're going to have a lot more equipment coming out of Iraq, we're sending more forces and equipment into Afghanistan, yet RESET is funded about $5 or $6 billion less than it has in previous years.
Well, can I offer a contrary view? And, we're all guessing about this, but my guess is that the chief in the Army will end up, got the former director of P&E in the Army here, and so he's been through this once, several times. But I think they're going to end up having to offer active duty and strength, because I don't think there's enough. I think the RESET problem is so bad in the state of the equipment coming out of these conflicts is so significant that the Army's going to be faced with the need, and the chief will say, I've got to have some sort of balance, and I hate to do it, but here's the balance I choose, which is somewhat less active duty and strength. It gets me a lot of money relatively quickly. Instead, I think the risk is going to be sustaining the deployments, whether the RC can step in and sustain the deployments, whatever they may be at that point.
Right. And as far as the Treasury accounts, the paying for the deployments, if a small tactical observation is helpful, I was in Afghanistan 2 weeks ago with SecDef, and we landed at, the British base near Lashkargah, and the Marines are there laying down those metal Lego pieces to build the second largest Marine Corps runway after 29 Palms. And it just is so obvious that a landlocked country, and our main hub into it is another landlocked country, it costs more to sustain an individual soldier in Afghanistan than anywhere else in the world, and we're only adding numbers there. I don't believe anybody said that to the American people, that this is just going to cost more. Look at the numbers coming out of Iraq. Well, each one that we move across is going to cost you even more.
Good point.
Yes, ma'am. Please identify yourself.
I'm Maren Lead with CSIS. Kim, I wanted to follow up on something that you said in your comments about the observation that the Army leaders are not as agile or as willing to mix it up, and ask you if you have hypotheses about why that might be the case, and also, Valerie, to get your perspective on that same question.
Okay, I'm willing to get into trouble here. I think the Army leadership, the Army process for pick leaders is much more focused on the field than it is on the skills that are needed to operate in this environment. I think they don't tend to promote people who have backgrounds and that is effective. And there's also actually a feeling, I've heard it from a number of general officers, they just don't like politics. They don't like to engage in politics. They don't feel comfortable with it, and so they choose not to do it. I do think it's unfortunate, really, that more of the general officers of all the services, but the Army in particular, don't get involved in going to the Hill, aren't actively involved in trying to sell their programs, because they have enormous credibility and they are the right ones in some cases to be over there doing it.
Well, it probably won't surprise anybody to hear that I completely agree with Kim on this. I think it's a cultural issue in the Army. I also think that we in the Army, we don't push the idea that going to Capitol Hill is part of your responsibility. If you look at Title 10, the responsibility of the chief and secretary is to man, train, and equip the Army. And we teach a lot at War College about how to fight. We teach a lot about Sun Tzu. We don't necessarily teach those guys how to go and win the fight for resources. Last year I was at the Army Gore College, and I was asked to come and talk to a class that was that had about 12 people in it. The class was all about working on was basically how do you go and deal with the legislative branch of government. So before the class, I talked to the instructor, and I said, how many folks in this class are going to be general officers? How many of them are going to be chiefs of staff of the Army and vice chiefs of staff of the Army? He looked at me like he couldn't believe I was asking the question. I said, how many of them are going to be future G3s, G8s, military deputies to the ASAF MNC? He looked at me and he said, ma'am, any of these guys are going to be lucky to become general officers. I think that says everything. If we do not make it a priority in our training, in our schoolhouses, then it will not be a priority for the Department of Army.
As far as the lack of political savvy, you both described the inability to go to the Hill and see that's part of your job.
Not inability. Unwillingness.
How much of that is institutional and historic cultural, and how much, may I say, is a legacy of the Rumsfeld years, a guy who heard the phrase Army of One and thought that was about the right end strength?
I should let the Army guys answer this question, but I'd guess that this is really more of an institutional and cultural issue, a historical issue.
Right, thanks.
Yeah, I mean, as a former Army guy, you know, only 20 years, but that you know, I can remember back. I mean, when I was a captain, I didn't even know what the Pentagon was. I mean, and even later as a major, and even as a lieutenant colonel, success was the least amount of time you could spend in the Pentagon, the better off you were. And, you know, stay away from joint assignments, get in 1 year, 2 years, the sooner the better, and get back to the field.
Thanks. Tom, just one other thing, and sure. Maybe just to stomp on this a little bit more. The Navy did a part of their human capital study about 5 or 8 years ago. They looked at, and they polled the admirals, what skills do you need to be effective as an admiral? And I don't think it would surprise anybody in this room, but most of them came back and said it's not the skills we learn from driving boats and being out and deployed. There are a different set of skills that we need to be able to manage and operate in the environments. And so they began to think about how do you create that. I don't think the Army has that feeling.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. As we approach the time for me to call for the last question, I wanted to pause now and say thank you to all the panelists for your time and wisdom. Thanks to the audience for being terrifically involved, and to those in uniform or who may not be in uniform today, thank you very much for your service to our nation. We all depend on you so very much and don't say thank you often enough. And who would like the last question? Yes, sir.
This is a little bit controversial, so I'm going to address it to Mr. Wasson, but
thanks.
The others can comment.
You
know, we've seen in the past, as we have different secretaries of defense, a different degree of, if you will, willingness of the chiefs to go to the Hill and say, I believe this, I want that, I don't like this, etc. This last time, of course, it looks to me, at least from the outside, like the SecDef made a decision, and as you said, everybody's backing into it. Even uncharacteristically, the Air Force, you know, has been very mum about several programs. In some ways, I think that's good, but in other ways, I think that could be difficult for people on the Hill to get honest answers from these guys that Goldwater Nichols says are the experts and are supposed to give their expert opinion to Capitol Hill, et cetera. So I'm just curious, is that a problem? Do you perceive that as a problem, or do you think we're headed the right direction?
Well, I would say, I mean, you know, maybe Goldwater Nichols needs to be changed a little bit, you know, as a result of this latest cycle. I don't know. Maybe that'll happen. We'll see what happens in the next couple of months. But I think, you know, the whole sequestering thing, or, you know, gag order, whatever you want to call it, I think from a budget perspective, and I think, you know, Ranking Member McHugh made this point at the HASC hearing. From a budget perspective, it's fine. The concern that you get into from an advise and consent perspective is when you get into these issues of acceptable level of risk, members need to know that they can go to the service chiefs and say, what does this mean in terms of the threat, in terms of the gap, things like that. So I think from a budget perspective, it's not an issue. I think the bigger issue along the Goldwater-Nichols on the advice and consent is the issue of requirements and capabilities and gaps. And you know, we'll see what happens.
Thank you all very much. Have a nice evening.
Add my thanks to our panelists and to Rolls-Royce, again, our sponsor, and to the patient, go the rewards. Help yourselves to drinks and refreshments, and hopefully we'll see you Monday here with General Mattis.